The title of the session is Beyond Inherited Order, Lone Arrangers, Legacy Arrangements, and Electronic Records. Many archivists inherit idiosyncratic arrangement systems established outside of, before, or without awareness of accepted standards. In archives employing lone arrangers, this situation is often compounded by the fact that their predecessors may not have had any archival training and likely left little information about the creation of the arrangement system. Additionally, most non-traditional systems had no space for electronic records. Applying current archival standards to legacy arrangements challenges the archivist to bridge the divide while respecting the integrity of their collections. The panelists will discuss how they move beyond the borders and barriers placed before them by the legacy systems they inherited. My name is Amy Robertson. I'm the Special Collections and Archives Librarian at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. I'm going to be moderating the panel today, and I'll go ahead and say if you have any questions, please definitely jot those down. We're going to have plenty of time at the end for questions. We're also going to have more of an informal conversation. That's why I'm sitting here and also our panelists. So we're going to cover some different themes today, and each person's going to speak about how that applies to them. We have Dara Baker. She is, as you can see, archivist and legislative researcher with the Export-Import Bank of the United States. She holds an MLS from the University of Maryland College Park and has a master's in history from Harvard University. A certified archivist, she currently works, as I said, as an archivist at the Export-Import Bank of the United States. She has undertaken research on American political history, early EAC implementation, and online descriptive systems in the UK. Before assuming her current position, she interned at the Center for Legislative Archives and the Royal College of Physicians, London. We have Deborah Kloiber, who's at the end. Deborah has been archivist and head of special collections at St. Catherine University, St. Paul, Minnesota, since 2011. Prior to that, she spent 11 years as curator of the, I hope I get this right, Ade Bethune Collection at St. Catherine, as well as managing the university's digital collections. Deborah's interest in archives arose from her background as a professional dancer, and she has worked with the collections of the American Dance Festival in Durham, North Carolina, and the Performing Arts Archives at the University of Minnesota. Deborah has an MSIS from the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and an AB in dance from Mount Holyoke College. We also have Helen Wong Smith. Let me get my notes down here. MLIS and certified archivist at the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. She's been there for 3 years and is currently responsible for the backlog of archival processing for 10 parks in the Pacific Island Network. A two-time president of the Association of Hawaii Archivists, she has just been elected to the ACA's nominating committee and has served on SAA's Committee on Education and the nominating committee. Helen has worked with Hawaiian archival materials for 30 years, becoming a certified archivist in 2001, a decade after receiving her MLIS. Her focus is on outreach to Narn archivists and digitization infrastructure. As part of a 2008 delegation to China with SAA past president Elizabeth Adkins, her interest in diversity in the archival profession was enhanced. Helen specializes in land-focused historical and cultural research for a wide audience, including archaeologists, historical societies, and government agencies. Unfortunately, we were supposed to have another panelist, and she couldn't be here today. Her name is Elena Wallace, and she's a librarian and analog data archivist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center. Her situation is really interesting because she's an analog archivist in a place that creates lots of digital data. So we're sad that she can't be here today, but if you have any questions, her email address is at the end. I didn't ask her if I could put it up there, but you can ask her questions. I'm sure it'll be fine. So let's go ahead and get started with the first question. Why did you decide to rearrange your collection? What was the condition, the physical and the intellectual condition of arrangement when you started?
So I'm going to start with this question just to make sure everyone can hear me, right? Okay, great. I started at the Export Import Bank in May 2011, about a week before getting my MLS, and I was technically the third archivist. The first archivist previous to that had also been head librarian, and the archivist who had the position before me was there for a legislative project and didn't actually touch any of the records. So when I showed up, I had this is the kind of thing you don't realize you need before photos until you get to after. So I'll be showing you an after photo of what my collection looks like, but just imagine walking into a library that somewhere buried in the back, there are a whole bunch of lovely Hollander boxes, and then a whole lot of unprocessed paper that is literally just paper, not in boxes, not organized at all, just stuck on shelves between books. And when I had my first researcher come in, outside of researcher, one of two, I realized that I had no idea how to access my collection because I have one giant access table for my entry point. Yeah. Also designed by someone who was an archivist but seemed to do it in a library fashion, so what I had was folder descriptions that were as long as historical book titles. And every entry, it required me to go in and do a keyword search to find anything useful. I also had an absolutely marvelous archives guide to resources that is 37 pages long for a 400 linear foot collection. So I realized very early on that I was going to have to rearrange for a number of reasons. The most important was that I couldn't even access my own material for reference requests that are coming in, let alone anybody else who may ask for a request. And I don't really have outside researchers. I do the kind of reference research that you're told in library school you're not supposed to. I give answers. But that requires me to do it quite quickly because most of the requests, as I'm sure a lot of you know, are please give me the information yesterday because we need to hand it into a government entity now. So as you can see, if you can go back to that first slide, sort of all of these why rearrange questions apply to me. it was completely idiosyncratic. There was no sense for how Export-Import Bank's structure had changed over time. I've been there about 14 months, and I still haven't been able to do a successful organizational history because nobody remembers. I really wanted to find a way to institute EAD or a digital asset management system other than my access tables. And I also have photographic and digital materials that had no space. So there was a separate archives access table for all of the audiovisual material that had a different record category organization than the analog records. So two completely different organizational systems. The records actually spoke to each other. I had paper records about transactional signings and photographs of transactional signings that didn't talk to each other, which I'm sure is an experience a lot of you have had. And then basically no way to incorporate the unprocessed materials, which I spent my first 3 months basically doing an inventory of these records, trying to figure out how they would go into the current system, and couldn't do it. It also important to know, and I should say this, is that the archive of the Export-Import Bank is particularly idiosyncratic in how it relates to the institution. There is a records manager who manages Record Group 275, which is at the National Archives. There is a library. The archive collection is non-record materials and copies of material that happen to end up in a space that needed to be organized. So it has a lot of information on the history of Export-Import Bank that isn't necessarily connected to the federal government sort of GSA general record schedules requirements, but has so much important information that won't end up in the National Archives. So that's sort of why the collection is around. And then, of course, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, where do you put electronic records when nobody knew what to do with them when the collection started in 2000? So.
Yes, and my collection is similar in many ways, although I'm at an academic institution. But when Dara first described her collection over the listserv, I sort of felt like, wow, this is exactly the situation that I'm in. I started in July of 2011 with my collection. I'm also the first archivist. The third archivist, but the first with any kind of archival training, background knowledge about the collection. Primarily, what I was told when I took over the job, the archives is set up with this very elaborate idiosyncratic coding classification scheme for where departments, offices, campus events, campus buildings, affiliated organizations, things that people in the university are interested into, everything's sort of given its own code in this extremely complex scheme that first it took me a while to even find any of the documentation that applied to what this current scheme is, what the various codes mean, but I was told pretty much right off the bat that since St. Kate's had transitioned in the last few years from being a college to a university and had completely changed the institutional structure now to reflect the new status as a university, that the existing coding scheme, which was really tightly integrated with the organizational hierarchy and divisions, needed to be changed to reflect the new one. So I was sort of told off the bat, you need to come up with a new classification for the system. And then as I got into it, I just realized, but the existing system that we had was just, it just was not workable. It was too complex. It was not set up by an archivist. It didn't really look at basic archives things like provenance. In many cases, it was arranged by subject rather than really looking at pulling all the records that came from, you know, one creator into one place, so that we could have correspondence from the office of the president in a variety of different places depending on what that correspondence pertained to. And also, in spite of the coding scheme, I mean, in the cases where it did try to pull, you know, everything from one office together in one code, there was no recognition of any kind of series. It was really, as far as I can tell, created like a huge vertical file. I'd say at least half of the collection is still in file cabinets and just arranged and handled more or less as individual folders. And as far as access to this idiosyncratic thing goes, the primary tool was a card catalog. Again, I think this reflects the fact that the first archivist, St. Kate's is a Catholic institution, all of our presidents have been nuns, and the first president, the sister that she lived with happened to be the director of the library, and so was getting some of, you know, kind of a library perspective on what to do. So yes, we have a card catalog. Everything's alphabetical by, again, name, place, subject, whatever, and the cards then tell us what code applies to that, so that then we can go to the vertical file and find, see the materials in that code. The other thing that we have is, as filing cabinets filled up, people would just pull records out and put them in boxes in numerical order. So the first batch of materials that was pulled and put in boxes one, and the last stuff that was pulled out of the folders and put the files and put in a box is 884. And so we have an Excel spreadsheet that's basically a box list. And it's arranged both alphabetically alphabetically by code, as well as numerically by box. So there's sort of, you know, two different sortings, but it is, again, like with your access table, it's, you know, do a find all to see if I'm looking for this, you know, where might it appear. What I'm hoping to go to now is I've implemented Archivist Toolkit for new accessions, and as I sort through this process and work with my existing collection, I'm going to get control over what I have that way.
Yeah, and we're sort of covering the basics, so you'll know where we're going with the next stage. So sort of, you know, this is sort of the introduction. We'll get deeper into it as we go.
Well, I feel your pain. I was brought in to the Park Service in 2010, and the first archivist that they've had in the Pacific Basin, you know, what we call the Pacific Island Network. And although that they would send out real archivists from the West Coast or different regions to come out, and they'll be there for 2 weeks or what have you, so there are remnants of their work in the collection. But unfortunately, in the hierarchy of the Park Service, the archivist usually, well, in our case, comes under the museum curator. So the majority of the collection was arranged as if they were museum artifacts. So if you had an accession, that was cataloged and processed as a separate collection. So you had all these discrete little pieces. This is the records from, these are the records from an archaeological survey. That's one collection. These are the records of this retiring interpretation chief. That's another collection. These are the records of this longtime employee, volunteer. That's another collection. So it was all over the map. And it was what made it worse as far as what they considered cataloging. They have a program that they use that was tweaked. It's essentially rediscovery tweaked for the Department of Interior. And what they did was they would put in the information in the accession module, basically put almost the exact information in the cataloging module, and hit a little button that said send to archives module. That was it. So it is still a discrete collection. And so the archives module, which nobody understood, it does have four levels, so you can have a hierarchy. It's when you use it properly, it's very nice. But it was just strange and foreign to them to even think of these records to have any kind of relation. So what one of the first things that I did is that, fortunately, the Park Service recognized that they have such a backlog of archival processing to address that they funded a multi-year project to address that, which is why I got to be in charge of 10 parks in the Pacific. I'm not complaining because I just got back from Samoa, so, you know, don't cry for me, Argentina. But it's a matter of places, these parks that have such a wealth of information, both natural and cultural resources, and alone, you know, just the variety, the diversity is phenomenal, but almost very just a small percentage has been actually processed or arranged in by archival standards, or even described, or to show the relationship or what's unique about them. So that was a real push. The chief archivist out of Washington said, "No, you've got to stop this. You've got to stop this individual collection, and you have to arrange all your records, whether they be analog or paper or digital. They have to be arranged by archival principles." So
we're very jealous, by the way.
Yeah, we are top down. Makes life a lot easier, you know. So so that's what I've been doing for the past couple of years, is convincing them that, and his mandate is actually one park, one collection. Some parks, I really can't do that because of the history of the way the collections had been previously. So for instance, at Hawaii Volcanoes, I'm so large, and we are going to celebrate our centennial in 2016, so we're one of the older parks, that I was able to convince them, okay, in this particular case, I'm going to have to make these discrete collections and arrange them by division, what have you. So how I've been able to rearrange the collections. It's not easy, but it's got to be done. Otherwise, you're just continuing mistakes of the past and making it almost impossible to find anything.
And one of the interesting things that came out, we sort of sent around a group of questions to each other, and one of the questions is, which is harder, intellectual or physical control? And I think I expected the answer for everybody to be intellectual, but it's actually physical control. It's going in and actually reboxing things, changing things, the amount of time. And if you're a lone arranger and if you don't have interns, you don't have assistants, trying to carve out the time to do it is crazy.
I was fortunate, I shared with Dara, that I actually had a student employee that loved shifting boxes. You know, oh, wow. I guess, you know, for the time she was there, you know, she didn't have to use her brain. It wasn't, you know, the kind of mental concentration in class. It's like, okay, I'm just moving boxes. Yes. Right, yes.
You know, investing for large enough erasers. I mean, it's the things you have to think about.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks so much for giving us some background and getting us started. The next thing I want to ask you about is electronic records. I think Dara has the most to say about this. So how and at what point in the rearrangement process did you decide to incorporate electronic records?
I think if we show the next slide, you'll see why. I don't know if you can read it, but at the very bottom, it's a record category on external communications. The bottom, it says, Ex-Im Bank intranet and internet go together under external communications. So I sort of looked at it and I said, first of all, internet and intranet are not both external communications. One of them is internal and one of them is external. The other one is, that doesn't work. So I really sort of was figuring out how to work with electronic records. And basically, I had electronic records. I have a small amount of sort of media, a couple of CDs, some DVDs, that kind of stuff. But mostly I have whatever's up on the servers that I'm allowed to sort of take for the archives. It's mostly digital photographs, press releases, that kind of material. So the first thing I did is do a small test pilot project with a file renaming for the digital photographs, which had been arranged by, I have no idea what. My particular favorite is a large file of about 1,000 photographs, and the file name was number sign K001P. Very helpful. So it's been a lot of work to sort of go in and figure it out, and the intellectual work was first that choice, and we'll talk about archival theory a little bit later, but do I keep my electronic record separate, like I did, like the predecessor did for audiovisual material and paper material, or do I really work on trying to integrate this as part of the collection and accession it the same way, understand it the same way, and make sure that the collection stays a living collection rather than a dead paper collection, and then an electronic record collection? And I err on the side of, like Ex-Im Bank, like most federal agencies, has pretty much gone digital, despite the fact that we still print lots of stuff out and stick it in boxes, don't tell anybody. Trying to make it a live collection, to make it all work together. And the sort of the fight that I've been having intellectually, but also with the tools that are available for archivists, is trying to figure out that way to keep representing archival hierarchy, the new arrangement schema that I've sort of come up with that incorporates all these materials, taking some of the material from here, calling it, not calling them record categories, which I don't know where they came up with it, but really making a space for signings that has a space for all of the digital records, all of the audiovisual analog materials, and all the paper materials so that they all speak to each other. And figuring out how to do that. Now, part of it was that when I was hired, I was told to do a master plan for the archives to incorporate electronic records. And I was told I would have no budget. And it was, all right, I have no budget. And should I make a plan that has a budget and no budget? It's, no budget. All of a sudden I had a budget. That's as much of a problem as not having a budget if you weren't prepared to think about what you could do if you actually had funds. So you end up having a completely different conversation about what kind of vendors, what is available, how you are going to incorporate records, and how do you think about the sort of granular nature of online electronic records fitting with your analog paper collection in the same space, and explain to a library staff, because I'm the lone arranger in a library, when they come to ask you the question of how many archival records do you have? And you have to say, I'm sorry, we don't measure it that way. It's like, well, why not? Because we don't. And so the explanation was about storage, and then asked about how many electronic records I had, because we're also putting together they're thinking about upgrading the ILS system. Like, well, you know, we just need the number of records. And like, but archival records are all different sizes, so you're going to need to know the size of the records for storage, not the single item, in order to be able to upload it. So a lot of what I've been doing has been a combination of translating for an entirely different audience, and then also trying to figure out, as a Lone Ranger, what kind of system and how I'm going to be able to make this work. At the moment, we're looking at a digital asset management system, but I have no metadata for my collection. I am refusing to use the access table as metadata. because it's basically incapable of being translated into anything, including Dublin Core. So I also unrealistically expected that by the time I came here, I would have an electronic record system to show you. No. And I think that's the experience that we're all having, is that the easiest part of this, which I didn't expect to be, was the intellectual rearrangement. To not be afraid of that part of the process, but to know that once you get that, there is so much left. And I think that's the message that I want to make sure that I get across here, is that rearranging, kind of like the term deaccessioning, should not be a scary word, but it is a big, daunting project.
I think that, again, I'm very fortunate, is that because of the presidential order that came down recently, and this was discussed in yesterday's government section, is that we have to accommodate for electronic records. Prior to that, there's a lovely volunteer who's the official, for me? Okay. Who's the official photographer, and he thinks that by dropping off a CD full of his electronic photographs from his digital camera, it should be going into the archives, and I've given him templates and of metadata, the basic metadata that I would like to have. Otherwise, it's not going to go anywhere in my archives, or the archives. And I think that the easier part has been, I mean, although it was novel for them, because they would formally go, oh, it's on a disc, oh, it's on a CD, then we're going to consider this an electronic collection. And to show them that intellectually it can go into the same collection, it's just that it's going to be done, it's going to be treated differently, if nothing else, just housed differently. But electronic records inclusion is now required into the federal records. So come hell or high water, whether we're ready or not, it's going to be done.
And mine, I have currently very few born digital materials in my collection, and so the ones that I do have already been incorporated into, I will call it, an arrangement scheme. But I know there is going to be getting more. Sort of my response to this is stay tuned. The university is actually purchasing a system for imaging paper documents as well as managing things that are born digital. And so I actually have a meeting scheduled September 6th to start talking about some of the issues related to this. So, in a way, I kind of see the fact that my institution has been a little behind the curve in electronic records as a good thing, because it's giving me an opportunity that when they are now ready to start up, I'm actually going to be in at the ground floor working with the records creators, the consultant that we've brought in, our IT people who are actually going to be managing the system. And so I'm just looking right away at the fact that I don't expect, from the conversations I've already participated in, that I will have any kind of physical control over the born digital records, but I do expect that those things that are scheduled for permanent retention, that I will be able to add the intellectual, part of them into the access tools that I have and the arrangement that I have.
Great, thanks so much. So the next topic we're going to cover is archival theory. Interestingly, Deborah and I both took the ACA exam on Tuesday, so I think theory is really in our forefront of our minds right now. And then when Dara started working on this project last year, she had just taken the exam. So we're all thinking about theory a lot. So it was great to tie theory and practice together in this particular situation. So Deborah, Dara, and Helen are going to talk about archival theory.
And I think with me, as you maybe can surmise from what I've said about my collection, the basic thing for me was just the fact that it had not been set up according to archival principles at all. And so, you know, what role did archival theory play? Well, right off the bat, my answer is, well, it had to play a role because it was non-existent to begin with. So things like really looking at provenance and not breaking up things by subject. Also, the whole, you know, vertical file and looking at things more as individual folders, and we have a catalog card for an individual folder, and they're all in this alphabetic thing. There was no sense of looking at any of the records in a, you know, sort of holistic manner, and what are the relationships between these records and the offices or people who created them.
I'm going to chime in. I think one of the, I shouldn't say it this way. When I was looking around for articles on rearrangement, which apparently is not a very popular topic in the American Archivist, I found there was someone at a university who basically took the Helen Samuels book and used that as the model for their archive. Which is great if you're also a small liberal arts college archive. But what I found, and I think came across for all of us, is it was a mix of things. I definitely didn't stay wedded to a particular concept, but when I was sort of rethinking about it, there were a couple of things that jumped out at me. Obviously, functional analysis, which sort of almost everybody who's doing it, particularly when you're working with federal records. But I was really attracted to the Australian series system because I have a collection. So I don't think I would say that archival theory was sort of a motivating force for me, although certainly best practices in what we're doing. But being aware of it and knowing the correct language to speak to, you know, they tell you this in grad school all the time, to speak to your stakeholders, to know that you have something to ground it in, and it's not just, I really want to do it this way because it makes a lot of sense to me, which in the end it really kind of is, but it's also based in those principles. So...
the only other thing, yes, that I was going to add is functional analysis, and even, although probably to a lesser extent than what you're doing, you know, sort of looking at the series system as well, so that whereas my original system was so wedded to the hierarchy, you know, I've been there a year, and we've already had one major institutional change. When we were set up as a university, all the departments were allocated into across four different schools, and about 2 months ago we decided to eliminate a school and a dean and go down to just three, and so now those departments have been broken up across two of the remaining three. And so the idea that being able to use other ways to describe what the hierarchy is, you know, putting that in an administrative history rather than having everything so tightly tied to the way it is now.
And I think theory has definitely been a huge seismic shift from volcanoes, for Volcanoes National Park and everybody else in the network, in the sense that it was really just the idea of appraisal and survey. What a concept. And then I would say, well, I need to come out and look at your collection that you're thinking of, you know. And that went hand in hand with outreach. So that was a huge shift in that the comments before were, for instance, the chief of natural resources said, well, I'm not going to give our records to the archives. We'll never see it again. That was their perception. And when I show them the first finding aid and show them how easy it was to retrieve or to identify and retrieve MOU with the Nature Conservancy or something like that, or all the records regarding the studies on this particular endangered species, it was a huge eye opener, and it was real basic to me. It was like, it's just basic, but they had never been introduced to archival theory and best practices. So just by doing that and showing them what an archive is, now they're more than willing to turn their records over to us. And in fact, I'm like, you mean if we turn it over to you and we get a FOIA request, you'll take care of it? Here, it's all yours. We don't have to spend the time Xeroxing everything. You know, it's like, yeah. So they're very good about that. That has gone hand in hand. There's also a lack of records management overview. And so I've also taken on that role and educating the staff in general, the difference between a library, because I'm a librarian as well, a library collection, an archival collection, the difference between what the description will do, how you would find records. So it's all very new to them. It's even getting to the outside, the community, the lay community. They're beginning to realize that, wow, the archives are run like an archives, even like some of the bigger ones in Honolulu or something like that. And so theory has meant the repercussions of instilling archival theory has really branched out just beyond of how you run shop.
I think it's given us all space to really make that differentiation between library and archive. To have sort of that underpinning, even if, you know, I'm certainly not as wedded to it. I have much more of a sort of a hybrid attachment to a number of theories that I had that seemed to work well with my collection. But it really does help give a sense for how the work that I do, the kind of collection that I have, is different from the library, and also very different from records management. Because we have a very strong records manager and a getting stronger everyday records management program, and identifying things for the archives can be very confusing for people if they already have a library and they have a records management, and working very hard to do the I might take it but I may not keep it message. So,
great, thanks so much. Next, what, in your opinion, was the biggest change you instituted? And Derry, you want to jump off?
I have an archival life cycle. Before I arrived, there were no accession forms. There was no way to figure out what we had, how we got rid of it. So I think for me, the sort of biggest impact on doing this is really getting to explain how it's so important when you have electronic records that you understand where they came from, you get that provenance message across, that you can then apply that to your paper records. I have a brand new file naming system that is helpful for locating materials as you go through them, and an arrangement schema that doesn't need 37 pages to explain. But I think one of the sort of biggest impacts for me, so it's I have a media neutral arrangement schema, and I'm begun work to implement a digital asset management system with descriptive tools that can help. It also really helps that my archive now looks like this. This is where I was saying I really wish I had a before instead of just the after. So the entire library moved into a new space, and the librarian and I had a lot of long conversations about what the archives should look like and how it should function. So whereas before, if I had a researcher who came in, and I'll admit I only had two, they sat in the library and I had to leave my workspace to sit with the person. Now there's a reference desk here, so there's always somebody if we do have somebody come in. And it's a million times easier to locate materials. I also, as you can tell, there's two different colored archives boxes. We actually purchased things in order to make space to expand the collection rather than assuming that it's going to stay the same size. So I think a large part of this sort of whole rearrangement process hasn't just been the intellectual and physical control. It's really been establishing where the archives fits in the institution and making a space for it, doing a mission statement, doing a collection development policy, thinking about user agreements, you know, originating deeds of gift, and finding ways for the archives itself, and myself as the archivist, to reach out to researchers within the institution and not make them come to me. So trying to anticipate the kinds of questions I could answer in the new system rather than, you know, oh, cool, look at the stuff I found in a box. Who can I tell about it? So and for me, that's really...
And some of those, I mean, when you say the life cycle, I did have the first archivist. We do have a couple notebooks of accession registers with the forms filled out. Of course, each accession was then given a manuscript number, and then somewhere along the way there was no reference between, oh, and this manuscript number applies to, or, you know, was then put into this code. So I have notebooks telling me what I have, but they're not really very useful because I don't know where those materials are. And then those notebooks, even I'd say in the last like 10, 15 years, just stopped being maintained. So yes, the whole idea of, you know, doing appraisal of what comes in, actually accessioning so that I have a record of what is there rather than just, you know, the students are given things to file, but there was nothing to do that, put any control over it, and then also just deaccessioning a lot of stuff that was acquired and no longer fits. So that just kind of looking at that whole process has been a big change internally, but I think as I start to work with the sort of people within the institution, I want to get away from the, you know, oh, I just found a file in my office that I don't need anymore and I want to send it to you, and getting these things piecemeal rather than, you know, okay, just clear out records that belong together, and I'd rather have them all at once rather than just sort of as you come across them and send them to me, and then they may or may not relate to anything that we already have, and they're just sitting there in an isolated fashion. I think the biggest change, both in terms of internal workings for me as a Lone Ranger and the undergraduate and graduate students I have working with me, but that will also impact users and the external community to the archives, is implementing Archivist Toolkit, which I have been using for probably 6 years now, maybe, with a special collection I was curator of. But implementing that for the archives, as I said, right off the bat, I said, anything that comes in, any accession, that's getting put in right away. So at least I may not know what's already here, but at least I'll have some control over the stuff that has come in while I've been the archivist, and beginning to create resource records and fuller descriptions then based on that, with the idea that as we go through this rearrangement process, the materials that we currently have will also be brought under fuller control. And then the external application of this is just being able to then produce finding aids and other access tools, because currently we have a card catalog, but it's not accurate or useful enough to me, so I would not give it, make it available to researchers. And in the past, the policy just was researchers do not have access to the card catalog. They don't have access to the archives databases. The website is just completely bare bones.
I think the biggest change that I've instituted is going from being reactive. Traditionally, they were reactive, waiting for people to bring things over to them, to being proactive, and that includes a huge amount of outreach. And then when you are complete, you finished doing a collection and making sure that they see the finding aid, see how it can benefit them, see how unfortunately, the Park Service, the way this whole project has gone, is that I'm not processing a collection at one fell swoop. I'm doing it by accession at a time. Remember how I explained how those accessions were created in the first place? So things are very piecemeal. And so when I create a hierarchy, I have to anticipate. I do interviews, and I have to anticipate that I may not have all the series with me right now, but they're going to be coming. So I anticipate that. And then they can see how nice it is once everything has been processed and the container list, and then they're more readily willing to hand over the series one or series two that they previously may not have. So I think being proactive and really getting out there and educating them is a huge change that I instituted.
So my last question for all of you, what are the lessons learned? What do you wish you knew when you started the project? What is the best advice you can give to someone who comes to the realization that rearrangement is their best option?
Wish I could have been a real hard ass. I really wish I could have been a lot more aggressive. I was so concerned about not coming in and going, hey, this is wrong. I got to do it this way. This is just terrible. And so I was very concerned, and that's a cultural trait too, is that you don't come in like gangbusters and you try to use, what was that book, Soft Power? So that, I think that recognizing that I could rearrange the collections. I was so worried about stepping on toes, and this is the first federal entity that I worked in, and I thought, ooh, what do I know? It's sort of like something that we talked earlier about electronic records. You know, what's the funny thing about standards? Okay, which one do you want to follow? There's so many of them, and I found that, you know, like there were these multitudes of electronic resource management systems in the Park Service alone. Imagine what there are in the rest of the federal entities. So that was kind of a real hurdle that I wish I had been able to say sooner, because then I wasted a whole year until this came on, this initiative came on to address the backlog of collections, and that would have really facilitated things, that I should have gone ahead with the rearrangement. And I think that if you present it to your superiors that this is the reason, this is not by archival standards, or this is not good practice, and this is the benefits of rearranging your collections, then you will be much better off. I waited until I was given that permission from, it was a really good wait.
Yep.
And I got it from the chief archivist and said, you got to do it this way. But I could have made things a lot easier in the long run.
And not necessarily, sort of recognizing that, yes, you need to do it. I think even knowing that you need to do it still doesn't necessarily prepare you for how much time it's going to take or how complex it's going to be. I had a system that was just incredibly complex, and I knew it needed to get changed. But again, sort of which standard, which theory do you want to adhere to? And with Dara, maybe it's kind of a hybrid, and then how do you figure out the hybrid arrangement that works best for you? And one thing that actually Elena shared her answers with us, we were all in discussion together, even though she couldn't be here, and something that she and I both found is that, yes, there are all these possibilities of how I want to rearrange it. And then not being afraid to have the feeling that the arrangement that I come up with on paper has to be absolutely perfect down to the slightest detail before I even start. I think we both felt a little paralyzed for a while before realizing that, just come up with, even if it's a sort of rough structure, and start working within that. And then as you actually start to you know, flesh out or do the rearrangement, you can flesh out some of the details. And for me, what helped was kind of just doing the physical rearrangement, the co-location, so that, you know, I took all of the boxes that were scattered in different places and just brought them together from one department so that I could really see what it was that I was dealing with, because the intellectual access was non-existent, so that didn't help me to see what I had. But just taking the materials, doing the shifting, and then realizing, okay, and then how that would fit into what I'd sort of started to work out, and then filling in some more of the details as I went.
And I had the opposite experience. There's no way I could have rearranged my system because I didn't have a box problem. I had a folder problem. So I would open boxes, and I felt a lot of the times that I had more folders than documents. So for me, I think we've heard the word test bed a couple of times for a lot of the sort of intellectual, a lot of the electronic and sort of linked data and that kind of stuff. I really use the sort of intellectual rearrangement component as a test bed. I came up with a couple of different options. I talked to as many people as I could who had experience doing this to sort of work out in my own head if I was going to make all this effort. And, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect the first time you come up with it. Play with it. Figure out what's going to work. And for me, I had a lot of things that seemed to fit in one place and didn't, and fit in multiple places. So we have a lot of independent agencies that that Ex-Im Bank works with. So something like PEFCO, which is the Private Export Finance Corporation, which is technically a subset of Ex-Im Bank, but is also a separate organization. So if you're trying to work on that hierarchy, where do they fit? So my big thing is fight for hierarchy. don't let that electronic record sort of individual item level measurement dictate how you arrange or rearrange your collection. Get those electronic records to fit into the archival hierarchy to make sure that those contexts make sure that that stuff sort of stays the same. And I guess the sort of other lesson learned is if you are thinking about making a plan and you have a choice between no money and money, do both. Try not to get caught short. Because for these kinds of things, for particularly in the federal government, if you're doing a requirement or you're doing something else, it's a really short deadline. And if you haven't done the research for it, and I know for most land arrangers we're spread in so many directions already, I would have been much better served if I'd taken the time to look at all of the options, even if they seemed like pipe dreams, to have that information going forward to do more detail. So...
Always prepare.
And talking, you know,
and yeah.
You talk about consulting with other archivists, and you talked about, you know, talking to people within your organization. And I think both are important. That part of what helped me when I'm faced with this scheme, and there are names of things that sound like maybe they could be the same, but they're given different codes, and why is that? Or, you know, are they the same? Are they not? Especially people I found talking to people that had been at the institution for a while and had some of that history, you know, I mean, that's helpful then to say, oh, okay, so, you know, this is how these different, you know, they sound like the same committee, are they really, or are they different? And you can get answers like that from that.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I just have a couple of words in closing. I think it's important to, if you decide that rearrangement might be a possibility or an option or will help you get a better control of things, make a decision and start doing it. Deborah definitely talked about that. So don't be paralyzed by, well, what if it's not right? What if it's wrong? Well, can you find anything right now? If the answer is no, then anything that you do is probably going to be better than what is in place. You know, rearrangement will help you incorporate electronic records. Rearrangement might help you answer reference questions more quickly. I mean, it has a variety of impact on your archive. So it's beyond just are you bringing things into current practice, or does everything look really pretty on a finding aid and physically on the shelf? So I think it has a lot of bigger implications for our work. Before we take questions from all of you, we're just curious, have any of you thought about rearranging your collections or have gone through that process before? Can you, like, raise your hand? Yay. Okay.
That's why they're here.
So this is something that we don't talk about this a lot, but it's something that a lot of us, I think especially Lone Rangers, might have to deal with.
And I will say, when I sort of, this came up from a strand from the Lone Rangers listserv, and I put it out there, I thought I was going to be the only one. because it really wasn't something that we talked about in graduate school. It was not, you know, you had an arrangement, you followed whatever you had, and, you know, legacy arrangements are really hard to undo, particularly if they have a long institutional history. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us, the other thing, I'm really lucky that my collection has not been cited by published authors much. It's something we didn't actually touch on.
Right.
But also something to keep in mind. You have to keep all your old stuff to correlate it to all the new stuff. Yeah. So
a lot of notes.
So
we have any questions? Okay, red shirt. Yeah. So she also works in a small university archives like Deborah does, and the question is, did you get any pushback from people in the library or people who had been working with the collection before?
I guess I can start that first. At this point, no. I think people using the collection before, not so much, because the access tools were never made available to them, so it was all pretty much just, you know, reference interview, what are you looking for? Oh, okay, I know, you know, what boxes, what code, whatever it is that you need, and I'm just going to bring them out to you. The only person really that would just go and use the collection is my boss, the library director. And the parts, I'm more or less just at the beginning of this process at this point. I've been there a year, but actually for that year, I was assigned 50% to finishing up a grant project. So, you know, you talk about I'm a lone arranger, and then I'm really only like a, you know, 30% or whatever archivist. So there's been a lot of stuff that I've done intellectually, but I haven't started doing a lot of physical. And when I do, it won't be a problem because she's the one that, you know, recognizes that there needs to be some new scheme anyway and is very supportive of what I choose to do with the collection. So I am fortunate. I know others are not in that position, and I'm actually, she's retiring at the end of December, so I may find myself not in that position in the near future myself.
I have to say I had pushback in terms of, are you sure you have time to do this? Are you sure this is the best use of your resources? Are you sure we can't just work with what we have? And you have to have answers to that. So mine really came down to, I am very inefficient at my job doing it this way. I know it's going to be a lot of investment. I know that the collection is probably not going to be as accessible for a while. But once we do this, it is going to be so much easier for me and for whoever who comes after me. Is sort of what I've, yeah.
Mm. So, which kind of gets back to a lesson learned that may seem obvious, but document, you know, whatever it is that you do, document it so that you don't end up
where
in the same position where you were, where it's like, well, why is it this way?
Yeah. I saw a hand before somewhere over there. Yes.
Right.
And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to whether the record schedule says anything about what should go to the
archives. So the question's about the record schedule. Does it say anything about what should go to the archives?
No. To be perfectly honest, the Export-Import Bank created a position for an archivist in 2000. They hired somebody. And then it just sort of morphed into something else. So when the library director hired somebody else, they had a different project. But the archives is not included in the general record schedule. But basically, I started work, and on my second day, I went, there's a NARA record group. I should go see what it has. And my boss was like, why? I'm like, because I need to tell what my collection is versus what's over there. I also was the first archivist to have a working relationship with the records manager, who is in charge of everything. So one of the things that we've had a lot of conversations about is they have the sort of the record transmittal form that you do for the National Archives. So we've been working on putting, you know, an informal box about sort of, is this of historical interest? Check. Let the archivist know. So it's very informal. I'm working on making it more informal. It may never be. But it's really carving out that space for the archives to be active rather than reactive, or in my case in particular, active rather than dead. So
we have time just for one more question, if anybody has any questions.
Yes.
You sure?
Okay. Well, if you think of anything, no.
Did you not add it?
I guess I did not add it.
We will make sure that we have all of our information on the slides that'll be put up for the Society for American Archivists, but, you know, come up here, you know, we'll be happy to talk to anybody. So we kind of apologize, it's Saturday, so you won't have a chance to really catch up with us, but...
Great. Thank you so much for coming. And like she said,
thank you for staying.